Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, let's start right off with the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all things wonderful in the world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up from Science Daily, data-driven definition of unhealthy yet pervasive hyper-palatable foods. A popular U.S. brand of potato chips once promoted itself with the slogan, "Bet you can't eat just one." Maybe that's because potato chips, like so many foods in the American diet, can pack a mix of ingredients apt to light up people's brain reward neural circuitry and overpower mechanisms that are supposed to signal when we've had enough to eat. Researchers call this class of foods, often processed foods or sweets with alluring combinations of fat, sugar, carbohydrates, and sodium, hyper-palatable. Multiple documentaries have pointed out that food companies have very well-designed formulas for these types of foods to make them palatable and essentially enhance consumption, said lead author Tara Fazzino, assistant professor of psychology at the University of Kansas. But these definitions are virtually unknown to the scientific community, which is a major limitation. If there's no standardized definition, we can't compare across studies. We just typically use descriptive definitions like sweets, desserts, and fast foods. That type of descriptive definition isn't specific to the actual mechanisms by which the ingredients lead to this enhanced palatability. This has been a substantial limitation in the field I thought was important to try to address. The team looked for items that met criteria established by their literature review as enhancing palatability, specifically where the synergy between key ingredients in food creates an artificially enhanced palatability experience that is greater than any key ingredient would produce alone. These identified synergies with specific values applied to three clusters: combinations of fat and sodium, such as hot dogs, bacon, or cheese; combinations of fat and simple sugars, like cake, ice cream, and brownies; and combinations of carbohydrates and sodium, like crackers, pretzels, and popcorn. Once the researchers were able to quantify characteristics of hyperpalatability, they applied their definition to foods cataloged in a large food database. They hoped to discover how prevalent hyperpalatable foods had become in the American diet. The authors found that 62% of foods in the database met the criteria for at least one of the three clusters they'd identified. Most, 70% of these foods that qualified were high in fat and sodium, such as meat dishes or eggs, and milk-based foods like omelets or cheese dips. Some 25% of the hyperpalatable foods were high in fat and sugar, and 16% of these foods were high in carbohydrates and sodium. Less than 10% qualified in more than one cluster. Most shockingly, items labeled as reduced or no fat, sugar, salt, or calories represented 5% of hyperpalatable foods identified by the researchers. Moreover, of all items labeled as lower, reduced, no sugar, fat, sodium, and/or sugar in the database, 49% met the criteria for being hyperpalatable. So there you go. The food industry is very good at getting us to eat just a little bit too much. Okay, well, let's switch to some good news. This from The Hill. Adult cigarette smoking rates hit all-time low in U.S. Cigarette smoking among adults has hit an all-time low, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. About 13.7% of adults, or 34.2 million people, smoked cigarettes in 2018, slightly down from the previous year. This marked decline in cigarette smoking is the achievement of a consistent and coordinated effort by the public health community and our many partners, Dr. Robert Redfield, CDC director, said in a statement. Yet our work is far from over. The health benefits of quitting smoking are significant, and we are committed to educating Americans about the steps they can take to become tobacco-free. Cigarette smoking is the leading cause of preventable death in the U.S., causing more than 480,000 deaths per year. Overall, 19.7% of adults use tobacco products, including cigarettes, cigars, cigarillos, e-cigarettes, smokeless tobacco, pipes, and hookah. While cigarette use is declining among American adults, e-cigarette use is increasing. 3.2% of adults said they used e-cigarettes in 2018, up from 2.8% in 2017. The study notes the increase was driven by young adults between the ages of 18 and 24. In all, tobacco use rates were highest among men, American Indian Alaskan Natives, people with low incomes, people who were LGBTQ, and those without insurance. If you are a smoker and wish to quit, feel free to call 1-800-QUIT-NOW for free help. Okay, this from the newsroom of the American Heart Association. E-cigarettes take serious toll on heart health, not safer than traditional cigarettes. E-cigarette use takes a serious toll on heart health, a big concern given the high prevalence of e-cigarettes and perception of e-cigarettes as a healthier alternative to traditional cigarettes, according to new research presented at the American Heart Association Scientific Sessions this year. Researchers who conducted two separate studies report they found e-cigarette smoking negatively impacts heart disease risk factors, namely cholesterol, triglycerides, and glucose levels, and decreases blood flow in the heart, similar to results among people who smoke traditional cigarettes. According to Rosemary Robinson, MD, the American Heart Association's Deputy Chief Science and Medical Officer, there is no long-term safety data on e-cigarettes. However, there are decades of data for the safety of other nicotine replacement therapies. The American Heart Association recommends people quit smoking using smoking cessation aids that are FDA approved and proven safe and effective. If people choose to use e-cigarettes as they work to stop smoking other tobacco products, they should also plan to subsequently stop using e-cigarettes. Because of the lack of information on long-term safety, and a growing body of data describing physiologic effects of the components of the devices and the chemical combinations used in them. Again, if you are a smoker of any type, feel free to call 1-800-QUIT-NOW if you're interested in free help in quitting smoking. Okay, next up from Science Daily, high numbers of youth report using prescription opioids in the past year. A new analysis of data from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health finds a surprisingly high prevalence of prescription opioid use among youth. As recently as 2015 to 2016, 21% of adolescents and 32% of young adults said they had used these drugs in the past year. Nearly 4% and 8% respectively reported misusing opioids. Of youth who reported misusing prescription opioids, 57% were obtaining them from friends or relatives, often for free, sometimes bought or stolen, versus only 25% from healthcare providers. In previous studies in adults, opioids were more commonly obtained from a physician. Our findings show that the focus of prevention and treatment should include close friends and family members of adolescents and young adults, not simply prescribers. Respondents who misused opioids, particularly the young adults, often reported having used other substances. Cocaine, 36%, hallucinogens, 49%, heroin, 9%, inhalants, 30%. At least half had used tobacco, alcohol, or cannabis in the past month. It is well known that teens and young adults are especially prone to becoming addicted once exposed to opioids, so the degree of exposure indicated by the study is worrisome. The findings complement the team's earlier study, which reported concerning rates of opioid prescribing to youth age 13 to 22 in emergency departments and certain outpatient clinics. Given these rates of opioid use and misuse, strong consideration should be given to screening adolescents and young adults for opioid use when they receive care. Okay, and a somewhat related story from Stat News. This is, an opinion piece from David Courtwright, PhD, professor emeritus at University of North Florida, has written several books on the history of addictive substances. His latest is The Age of Addiction, How Bad Habits Became Big Business. And this article is Vaping and Prescription Opioids, Limbic Capitalism in Action. I had just finished a new book on addiction when the vaping crisis erupted. The gist of the book is that globalization, industrialization, mass marketing, digitization, and social media have turned the ancient human preoccupation with disreputable, potentially addictive pleasures into lucrative, commercially normal enterprises. Bad habits have been McDonaldized. Vaping couldn't have been a more perfect example of this. I call those who help make bad habits routine limbic capitalists, a reference to their product's neural common denominator. Whether they sell junk food, porn, slots, computer games, alcohol, or drugs, they target the limbic system, the brain networks responsible for pleasure, motivation, long-term memory, and other survival functions linked to emotions. Biological evolution shaped the limbic system, which is indispensable for life and reproduction. But cultural evolution and technological change created a trap door. The same neural pathways can be exploited, lethally, by entrepreneurs of brain-rewarding products that foster excessive consumption and addictive behavior. I analyzed several categories of mortality data from the World Health Organization and found that for every premature death from homicide or war-related violence, there were 30 premature deaths from unhealthful practices such as smoking, overeating, or distracted driving. Bad habits may be big business, but they are also big killers. The surest way to recruit the heavy regular users who provide the bulk of limbic capitalist profits is to entice them at an early age. With e-cigarettes, the incentive to do so was especially strong. Reducing harm is by substituting nicotine vapor for tobacco smoke, though a promising idea had an obvious economic downside. Adult vapors would eventually die or wean themselves away from the nicotine. They could be replaced, but beginning in the late 1990s, smoking among U.S. teens began a sustained decline. Given that the U.S. was easily the world's largest e-cigarette market, and given that the odds of smoking diminished rapidly as non-smokers mature through their 20s, the future looked like it would be filled with millennials with no need of e-cigarettes and no association of pods with anything other than sci-fi movies. Unless, of course, vaping became the new original source of nicotine dependency. In hindsight, the temptation for e-cigarette pioneers resembled the one that faced opioid manufacturers and distributors before the 1990s, when physicians prescribed narcotics for cancer, surgery, and trauma. The illicit market for these painkillers was ethical and self-limiting. Patients died or recovered. But then the industry's patiently orchestrated campaign to liberalize opioid prescribing for chronic non-cancer pain and the ensuing overpromotion and oversupply of drugs like OxyContin greatly expanded the market and triggered the entwined epidemics of iatrogenic and diversion-based opioid addiction. By the way, iatrogenic means produced by healthcare. There is the word for the day. The latter, diversion-based opioid addiction, disproportionately involved young males, the same demographic most prone to vaping-based nicotine addiction. The limbic capitalist moment for e-cigarettes arrived in 2015, just as the prescription opioid addiction crisis was transitioning to its heroin and fentanyl phase. In June of that year, Pax Labs launched Juul, a compact, concealable, and customizable e-cigarette ideally suited for an adolescent marketing campaign. Some early Juul promotions were conventional. Samples doled out at movies and concerts. Glam ads featuring the ripped Gene Young. But the startup's biggest marketing assets were the internet and social media. Juul, whose vaporizer resembles a USB drive, took advantage with a barrage of tweets, Instagram posts, YouTube videos, and paid media influencers. Juul had another hook for youths: fruity flavors. These reflect an older tactic I call blending. Economists tend to miss its significance because they slot limbic capitalists into categories like big tobacco, but their actual products involve artful hedonic manipulation. Think of menthol, aromatics, and nicotine-enhancing ammonia in cigarettes. Some additives, such as sugar in cereals and sodas, have the further benefit of enticing young consumers. Juul worked the trick with mango and Cool Mint. Recording vaping tricks and uploading them for fun, instruction, and the likes provided a juvenile sweetener of another variety. Then Juul ran into two problems inherent to commercialized vice. One hitch was that other limbic capitalists, including counterfeiters and black marketers, could also play the additives game. Skip the nicotine, advised a 2018 High Times article, and fill your Juul pods with THC oil, assuming it really was THC oil. Any enhancement or substitution increased the risk of toxic adulteration, suspected as a contributor to the 2019 outbreak of acute lung injuries among those who make or buy customized cartridges with alternative flavors and drugs. As with prescription opioids, many of the knockoffs could be traced back to Chinese manufacturers and internet vendors. That so many hospitalized vapers, current median age of 24 years, were young, aggravated a second threat facing the industry. In December 2018, news broke that rates of self-reported vaping had jumped from 11% to 21% among high school seniors, the biggest one-year increase in drug use ever recorded in the Monitoring the Future survey. An estimated 1.3 million more high school students were vaping in 2018 than in 2017. By mid-2019, parents had begun filing lawsuits on behalf of their addicted minor children, while federal regulators proposed banning e-cigarettes of the flavored variety. In September, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker went further, imposing a four-month ban on sales of all vaping products. The legal blowback is consistent with the history of limbic capitalism. Societies reserve their strongest condemnations for addictive products that target the youth, on whose health the future depends. Nothing scandalizes the public like hooked teenagers on respirators or on morgue slabs. Knowing how sensitive this nerve is, limbic capitalists have often countered with strategic walkbacks and PR buys. This year, Juul ran a series of full-page ads in the Wall Street Journal advocating raising the age of legal purchase and tougher ID checks for vaping products. Attentive readers could not help but notice how closely the new vigilant tone of the Juul ads echoed that of Purdue Pharma. "We make prescription opioids, and we want to limit their use," ran in the Journal in late 2018. If the ads were too late for Purdue, they were nonetheless instructive for historians looking for patterns in the distant and more recent past. The pattern for the vaping scandal and for the opioid crisis and for proliferating addictions generally is that of limbic capitalism. Step away from the headlines, take a closer look at vaping, and you will see but the latest blossom of the prettified thorn bush of commercialized vice. Next up from NPR, the CDC says childhood trauma is a public health issue and we can do more to prevent it. Childhood trauma can lead to long-term health problems. More should be done to prevent it, says the CDC. Childhood trauma causes serious health repercussions throughout life and is a public health issue that calls for a concerted prevention effort. That's a takeaway of a report published from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Experiencing traumatic things as a child puts you at risk for lifelong health effects, according to a body of research. The CDC's new report confirms this, finding that Americans who had suffered adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, A-C-E-s, were at higher risk of dying from 5 of the top 10 leading causes of death. And those who had been through more bad experiences, such as abuse or neglect, witnessing violence at home, or groping in a family with mental health or substance abuse problems, were at even higher risk. 1 in 6 people across the United States has experienced 4 or more kinds of adverse childhood experiences, according to the report. That's why it's important to prevent adverse childhood experiences and lessen their impact on individuals, said the CDC's principal deputy director, Dr. Ann Suchot, at a teleconference. Preventing ACEs can help children and adults thrive and has the potential to substantially lower the risk of conditions like asthma, cancer, depressive disorder, and diabetes. The new report presents the CDC's first estimate of how many Americans are affected by adverse childhood experiences. as well as the potential benefits of preventing these kinds of traumas. Using data from a survey of more than 144,000 adults from 25 states, the report found that about 60% of Americans experience at least one adverse experience during childhood, and 15.6% experience four or more different types. Women, American Indian and Alaskan Natives, and African Americans have the higher risk of experiencing four or more types of childhood traumas. The effects add up. The more types of adverse childhood experiences a person has, the higher their risk for negative outcomes, which will limit their opportunities their whole life. But these health outcomes are preventable. Preventing childhood trauma could potentially prevent 1.9 million cases of coronary heart disease, the leading killer in this country. Similarly, it could prevent 2.5 million cases of obesity or overweight and 21 million cases of depression. Trauma in childhood can also affect a person's social well-being. Adverse childhood events also negatively affect life opportunities, like completing high school or future employment. Preventing adverse childhood events could have kept up to 1.5 million students from dropping out of school. Studies have shown that there are ways to prevent childhood trauma and mitigate its effects when it does happen. The agency points to the need for efforts at every level: state, community, family, and individual. Shuchok noted that positive childhood experiences and relationships are known to buffer against the stress of trauma and strengthen resilience. It might be a parent, it might be a teacher, it might be a neighbor, but having a stable, reliable person in your life can help you at that individual level with resilience. That stability and nurturing will help you when you have stress or a difficult problem, because you have an outlet and a reliable way to process it and seek help if you need to. Mentoring programs that connect children with caring adults at school or in the community have been shown to support children through difficulties in their life. In fact, supportive nurturing relationships and environments for both children and families are at the heart of prevention, according to the report, which describes six approaches to prevention. These approaches include strengthening economic support for families, helping parents and youth better handle stress, as well as improved access to primary care to screen, identify, and address childhood trauma when it occurs. Everyone has a role to play in prevention, Suchat said. Parents, families, neighborhoods, schools, spiritual communities, businesses, and government can all help. Okay, and a somewhat related story, this from the New York Times. Getting a handle on self-harm. Self-injury, particularly among adolescent girls, has become so prevalent so quickly that scientists and therapists are struggling to catch up. About 1 in 5 adolescents report having harmed themselves to soothe emotional pain at least once, according to a review of 3 dozen surveys in nearly a dozen countries. But there are very few dedicated research centers for self-harm, and even fewer critics specializing in treatment. When youngsters who injure themselves seek help, they are often met with alarm, misunderstanding, and overreaction. The apparent epidemic levels of the behavior have exposed a structural weakness of psychiatric care. Because self-injury is considered a symptom and not a standalone diagnosis like depression, the testing of treatments has been haphazard and therapists have little evidence to draw on. In the past few years, psychiatric researchers have begun to knit together the motives, underlying biology, and social triggers of self-harm. The story thus far gives parents, tens of millions worldwide, some insight into what is at work when they see a child with scars or burns, and it allows for the evaluation of tailored treatments. In one newly published trial, researchers in New York found that self-injury can be reduced with a specialized form of talk therapy that was invented to treat what's known as borderline personality disorder. It used to be that this kind of behavior was confined to the very severely impaired, people with histories of sexual abuse, with major body alienation, said Barrett Walsh, a psychologist who was one of the first therapists to focus on treating self-injury. Then, suddenly, it morphed into the general population, to the point where it was affecting successful kids with money. That's when the research funding started to flow, and we've gotten a better handle on what's happening. The most common misperception about self-injury is that it's a suicide attempt. A parent walks in on an adolescent cutting herself or himself, and the sight of blood is blinding. A lot of people think that, but in reality, you cut for different reasons, said Blue, 16, another high school student in the New York area, who asked that her last name be omitted. Like it's the only way you know to deal with intense insecurities or anger at yourself. You're so numb as a result of depression, you can't feel anything. And this is one thing you can feel. Among current American college students, a privileged group by definition, about 1 in 5 reports having inflicted self-harm on purpose to ease emotional pain at least once, according to surveys done at 10 universities by Janice Whitlock, director of the Cornell Research Program for Self-Injury and Recovery. The first episode occurs around age 15 on average, but a large number of people who self-harm started later, at age 17 or 18. Few people who self-harm once stop there, said Dr. Whitlock, who is an author of Healing Self-Injury, A Guide for Parents. About 3 in 4 continue, and the frequency tends to go up and down as people go in and out of various stages, she said. It's absolutely crazy-making for parents because it's hard to know what's happening. This on-again, off-again pattern becomes, for about 20% of people who engage in it, a full-blown addiction, as powerful as an opioid habit. People who become dependent on self-harm often become to treasure it as their one reliable comfort, therapists say. Images of blood, burns, cuts, and scarring may become, paradoxically, consoling. In isolation, amid emotional turbulence, self-injury is a secret friend, one that can be summoned anytime without permission or payment. Unlike emotional or social pain, it's possible to control physical pain, and its soothing effects, said Joseph Franklin, a psychologist at Florida State University. Dr. Franklin argues that the brain circuits registering physical and mental pain, while distinct, likely have some overlap. The burn of humiliation feels very different from the burn of fire, of course, but there is some evidence that the relief from yanking a hand away from the flame can activate neural circuits that register psychological relief, although the system is far from worked out. In the research literature, the sensation of release from either physical or social pain is called pain offset relief, and by most accounts from those who self-harm, the use of one to blunt the other can become addictive. As a weird quirk of this effect, people who think the relief of psychological pain is worth the physical pain may reason that self-injury is a good idea. In psychiatry, self-injury is considered a symptom, not a standalone disorder. As a result, people who habitually injure themselves often receive an underlying diagnosis, like depression, attention deficit disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, borderline personality, bipolar, or some combination, which may change from doctor to doctor. If a diagnosis does fit, experts say, treatment should integrate it. In a paper that appeared this summer, a team led by Theodore Beauchene of Ohio State University argued that pre-adolescent girls with a history of family trauma and attention deficit disorder are at extremely high risk for later self-injury. And treating the ADHD as well as the traumatic stress would be a powerful prevention strategy and could reduce later suicide risk. The one treatment that appears to be most effective for breaking the habit of self-harm is a specialized talk therapy, originally invented for people with a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, who are highly suicidal. Habitual self-injury is a risk factor for later suicide, and those who engage in it, like people diagnosed with borderline, endure gusts of dark emotion. Through one-on-one and group therapy sessions, at least once a week for 2 months or more, people who injure themselves learn a series of coping skills to weather troughs of misery. These skills include mindfulness techniques and opposite action, in which patients act opposite to the way they feel in order to alter the underlying distress. The therapy is called Dialectical Behavior Therapy, or DBT, and was developed by Marcia Linhine, a psychologist at the University of Washington. In a study of 800 adolescent inpatients at Zucker Hillside Hospital in Glen Oaks, New York, a team of doctors found that those who received dialectical behavior therapy had far fewer incidents of self-injury, spent less time on suicide watch, and had shorter hospital stays, by 2 weeks on average, compared to adolescents who had been treated before the DBT was standard. Another kind of standardized talk therapy, called cognitive behavioral therapy, can also be adapted to help people who habitually self-harm. Both strategies are more likely to be helpful when driven by the person in pain, a recent review found. There is real hope if you let the person going through this have some control. If you listen to them, if you're curious about their behavior and not afraid of it. Okay, next up from Stat News. An estimated 35,000 Americans die of antibiotic-resistant infections each year, one every 15 minutes, according to a stark new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that reveals that the problem is substantially greater than previously estimated. The new report, the first update of a landmark 2013 publication that estimated the scope of drug resistance in the United States, used better data sources to recalculate the estimates of the earlier version. The upshot? Deaths from drug-resistant infections in 2013 were nearly double what the CDC estimated them to be at the time. Instead of 23,000 deaths, the 2013 total is now estimated to have been 44,000. In the interval, efforts in hospitals to limit the spread of resistant bugs among their patients have brought the number of deaths down, with the CDC now estimating 35,000 people dying each year from them. That's an 18% reduction. The report shows us that our collective efforts to stop the spread of germs and preventing infections is saving lives, said the CDC's director. Today's report demonstrates notable progress, yet the threat is still real. Each of us has an important role in combating it. Experts who reviewed the report warned that it isn't a fight that will ever be won. The germs evolve, and so does the battle to limit the damage they do to mankind. A key message of the report is that people need to stop thinking of difficult-to-treat or untreatable infections as a future threat. Okay, next up, some good news. Reminds me a little bit of how old I am. When I started working in HIV/AIDS almost 30 years ago, the idea of developing an HIV vaccine was around but not considered very likely. But here from Science Daily, groundbreaking HIV vaccine design strategy shows promise in proof-of-principle tests. A collaborative team of scientists has made a successful proof-of-principle demonstration of an advanced HIV vaccine strategy, an approach that may also work in protecting people from an array of other deadly infectious diseases. The team, led by scientists at Scripps Research, also included the Ragon Institute of Massachusetts General Hospital, MIT and Harvard University, the La Jolla Institute for Immunology, and IAVI, a scientific research organization focused on HIV and other global health challenges. The new vaccine strategy centers on stimulating the immune system to produce broadly neutralizing antibodies against HIV. These special antibodies are capable of neutralizing many different strains of the fast-mutating virus by binding to important yet difficult to access regions of the virus surface that don't vary much from strain to strain. A vaccine that eliminates such antibodies could save many millions of lives and billions of dollars, and ultimately may help eliminate HIV as a significant public health problem. Woohoo! Based on a concept called germline targeting, this novel strategy could potentially provide protection against the millions of different strains of the virus circulating globally. Achieving this goal has so far been elusive. No HIV vaccine candidate has ever been shown to induce a protective response in humans through broadly neutralizing antibodies. I believe that we need a germline targeting strategy to develop an effective vaccine against HIV, and the same type of strategy may be helpful in making vaccines against many other difficult pathogens, says the study's co-senior author, William Scheif, PhD, a professor at the Department of Immunology and Microbiology at Scripps Research. Here, with a great collaborative effort among multiple labs, we've shown the feasibility of a general germline targeting approach. Good news. Okay, well, let's switch to some bad news, or back to bad news. This from ProPublica. In a notoriously polluted area of the country, massive new chemical plants are still moving in. The industrial stretch of the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, a region known as Cancer Alley, is one of the most highly polluted areas in the country. A ProPublica analysis using a scientific model developed by the Environmental Protection Agency shows that some of the neighborhoods where new plants are being built already have a very high concentration of toxic chemicals. But Louisiana continues to approve the building of new plants and the expansion of existing ones. Okay, we're going to close off with a story from the Washington Post. Delhi is engulfed by toxic pollution. Why isn't anyone wearing masks? Despite living with some of the world's worst air, very few residents of India's capital wear anti-pollution masks, which can filter the vast majority of harmful particles if worn correctly. The paucity of such masks stands in stark contrast to cities such as Beijing, another megacity known for acute smog, where it's not unusual to see people wearing them. But Delhi's doubts about masks may be fading. Pollution here spikes every autumn as a toxic stew of pollutants, industrial emissions, road dust, car exhaust, and soot from agricultural fires settles over the city. Despite various efforts to combat pollution, Delhi just recorded its longest stretch of hazardous air quality since public records began. Authorities have closed schools for 4 days this month and banned half the city's cars from the roads every day. The reasons people in Delhi are reluctant to wear masks are complex. For many of the city's poorer residents, even the cheapest disposable pollution mask, which costs around $1.25, may be prohibitive. But other factors are also at play, including a lack of awareness of the health risks posed by air pollution. Even those who know the dangers say masks are uncomfortable, socially awkward, or inadequate to the enormity of the problem. Now there are signs that such attitudes are beginning to shift. This year, for the first time, the Delhi state government announced that it would distribute 5 million anti-pollution masks to students across the city. The masks, dark gray with red adjustable straps, began arriving in schools at the start of the month. Disposable pollution masks are showing up at small general stores. Companies have offered them as part of sales promotions, and some employers are giving them to their staff. Researchers at the University of Chicago conducted surveys around mask-wearing behavior among 3,500 of Delhi's poorest residents. They found that the awareness of the harm pollution causes is still relatively low, and that social norms may discourage people from wearing masks. Even if local and federal authorities take strong actions to combat Delhi's bad air, it would take a number of years for pollution to come down, said Kenneth Lee, one of the researchers. In the meantime, defense is sort of important. One of the reasons for the higher prevalence of pollution masks in China is experience, said Christopher Dobbing, who lived in Beijing for 7 years and founded Cambridge Mask, a company which makes anti-pollution masks that retail in India starting for $10 apiece. In China, people wear surgical masks when they are ill to prevent their germs from spreading, a practice that intensified during outbreaks of the SARS virus. The concept of wearing masks in public is already ingrained in the culture, he said. Meanwhile, in Delhi, a sense of futility and despair enters the conversation around pollution on such days. Early in the morning, Shrikant Malik, 21, a national medalist in track and field, was training with several other sprinters in Delhi's Lodi Garden. A musty haze hung over the park, and the air quality index was in the hazardous category, as measured by the U.S. Embassy. None of the young athletes were wearing masks. Masks are too uncomfortable, Malik said. He added that when the pollution is extreme, he feels a burning in his throat and begins to cough. Living in Delhi, you feel like you're closed in a room, Malik said. It is only after leaving the city that you feel like you've gone outside. Well, we're ending on that note for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, toppun.com. If you'd like to review this show, listen to previous shows, or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.